Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense. We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies. Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to learn 5 zesty biohacks you can do using the Arby's Dollar Menu.
Follow us on Twitter at School Sucks Show. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username School Sucks Podcast, and get involved in our Facebook group.
All right, so we're just going to start, and this is just going to be super relaxed, and we're just going to have a great time.
When I think about you, the word relaxed comes up.
Why?
Because you're so chill.
Do I sound sleepy?
No, you have a very relaxed demeanor when you speak publicly. You're the same exact way when you speak publicly as when you speak privately to people. You're just very relaxed, very calm, fluid, just peaceful kind of person. I think that's one reason I like you.
Yeah, I'm going to accentuate that.
Sure.
Peacefulness.
Yes. So, everyone should be that way.
You think so?
I think everyone would be a lot happier if they were. I talk about this all the time, that people need more silence in their inner selves. They need more space and to find some peace. With all the noise that we have in our daily lives, in our minds, it's very difficult to find any peace.
Hey everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is December 17th, a rainy December 17th evening. Looks like we've got El Nino again. I didn't know this El Nino was going to come back. I thought that was a one-time Nino. Hit us, I think, in the late 90s, and it's back again for more. You know? Ay Dios, Ninos. But I do have Jordan Page on the show for the first time ever. Jordan, very well-known musician. A lot of his music has Liberty themes in it. I'm going to be playing some of his songs today. There'll be a couple of intermissions in this show for Jordan Page songs. But also, gosh, I got to tell you, one of the nicest and most decent people I've met in a long time. Jordan and I spent some quality time together at Pork Fest. I just have to say, I was very, very grateful for the opportunity to get to know Jordan better. He was in town last week. I invited him to the studio, and we sat down for about an hour and a half and rapped. You're going to hear about an hour of our discussion in the regular podcast. There's more. There's like a 20-minute pre-show, and that's going to go in the AV Club. But I really wanted to talk to Jordan about the things in the title today. Home education, the concept of self-governance, and the future. I brought up a lot of, you know, my concerns I had for a long time. Whenever I considered the possibility of becoming a parent, Jordan has 6 children with his wife, and they will all be home educated. And that's certainly a big part of our conversation today. I appreciate everyone's feedback about the last show, positive or negative, whether it was praise or filled with horror, everything in between. This is going to be the last time this year, by the way, you hear me talking just to you in one of these opening monologues. So I just want to say I hope you have a magnificent holiday, and I hope you get to spend time with friends and loved ones. All we've got left to do in 2015 is that Podcast Masters Liberty Masterclass, still working away on that. And I've got a little gift for all of the thousands of people who listen to the show but haven't yet supported it financially, coming in the next 10 days or so. Thanks again, everybody, for another great year of participation, our 6th full year of doing this program. And please check out Jordan Page at jordanpagemusic.com, and listen up at the end of the show. Jordan will tell you about some of his short-term goals. He's trying to get back into the studio. If you're a fan, there's ways you can help. When we pick up our discussion, we're talking about Jordan's wake-up process, his embrace of the philosophy of liberty, and how that translated into his home and into the education of his children.
My understanding of the world as it is now is so vastly different than what it was in 2006,
yeah,
10 years ago. So I can't put anything past the powers that be as far as, you know, deception about reality. So I question everything. And my default position is skepticism now. My default position is I don't believe the official story. When I watch the news, I'm just I'm picking apart what the actual agenda is. Why am I being shown this? What is this covering up? Why am I being distracted by this? Something else is going on. Let me go find out what that is. That's where my mind works now, because I understand that I am the recipient of a lifetime of propaganda and lies. And my worldview was destroyed when I was 29 years old, you know, through the process of learning what's really going on in the world. And I built it back up with facts rather than tradition and with reason and logic and research rather than emotions and bias and prejudice. At least I believe that I've done that.
You know. Well, let me ask you this. You know, you talk about coming to a new understanding of what's going on around you through maybe the InfoWars route. Is that fair to say?
I think InfoWars was an early influence. I think InfoWars created the real emotional reaction that I personally needed to become personally invested in finding more. I mean, you know, InfoWars has its problems like anything does.
Sure.
But some of those documentaries that Alex Jones made, you know, years ago, had a profound impact on me early on in my development. I mean, that's not my only source of information. I'm constantly doing. I'm a research junkie. Like I want to hear all sides of an argument before I make a judgment. But I tend to lean to the side of incredulity when it comes to the official understanding of a particular issue.
Yeah, it's not even so much information. That's a big part of it. But I think about, for me, and I wonder if you had a similar experience. I kind of woke up, or started waking up. I think waking up is kind of a continuous, ongoing process, right? But I was introduced, maybe it was like 2004, to Coast Radio, and then I heard Alex Jones on there in 2005, and I got really into that. And I thought there might have been some kind of, and this will transition a little bit into our discussion of home education, a liability in that kind of psychic disruption, you know, because it wasn't the information content. It had a lot to do with the emotional content of it, that it really affected the way I communicated with people very negatively for a long time. And then, you know, like Free Talk Live, Free Domain Radio in the subsequent years, as I kind of honed in on the philosophy of liberty, also didn't help. Now, that's not their problem. I'm not even saying it's Alex Jones's problem. It was the way that I was trying to, you know, embrace that information and then transmit it with a great sense of urgency to other people. So did you go through that?
Did you wind up alienating
people?
Absolutely. I alienated members of my family.
Yeah.
I alienated friends, people that I went to college with. I'm not convinced that that was necessarily a tremendous loss.
Sure.
Because I think a lot of those people are based on their reactions to information, or based on their position, their public positions that they take, we're on very, very different sides of a line. I am interested in moving society in the opposite direction of tyranny, which is where we are headed down. And it's a lot of people that I have lost during the last 10 years of becoming an activist and a liberty person, a truth person, they want more of the same. Everyone just wants control of the machine apparatus. They want control of the violence to impose their will on other people. And as an anarchist, I don't believe in that. I don't have the right to initiate force against you, and it's not inherent in my humanity. I wasn't given that right by nature to impose violence against you to get what I want. So I don't have that right in order to transfer that right to someone else, to another, to a third party, in order to do it for me. But that's essentially what government is. It's a violence apparatus that extorts wealth from us and imposes violence upon us and upon all and all over the world in order to pursue its own ends. And I'm just not interested in that. And it seems like everyone just wants control of Slavery Incorporated, and I'm somewhere completely different.
So how do you bridge that gap today with people? Or do you feel like there was a kind of cleansing when you went through that caustic communication phase that a lot of us go through? And yeah. But you still must encounter this today. I mean, you talk to a lot of people. You travel a lot. You know, we were at a party last night, and you were talking to somebody. And I was grabbing some chips and kind of eavesdropping.
Right.
And I realized that you two weren't exactly on the same page. So how do you deal with that today?
I try to just answer questions in as calm and rational a way as possible. And if I don't have an answer, I'll say I don't have an answer for that.
Mm-hmm.
It's not important for me to be right. I think a lot of folks that argue with me, it seems to me that they want to be right, and they don't want to be perceived as being wrong. They want to win the argument. I'm not interested in winning the argument. I'm interested in normalizing some terminology that has been demonized by the state. There's a great quote that I love where it says the true measure of the state's success is that the word anarchy scares people and the word state does not.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to normalize this word for folks and have it not be a scary word. And you know, as a Christian, I find that the only political ethos that works in congruence with my spiritual path is the philosophy of anarchy, the philosophy of voluntarism. You know, these two ideas they work together. There's no other political philosophy that is not at odds with my path in Christianity. So it makes the most sense to me. It comes from a moral and logical place that does not involve using violence and fear and coercion in order to force people to do what I want them to do.
So let's take all of those lessons and all of that information and let's take it to your home, to your educational environment.
Yeah.
What's the best way to say this? How do you pass that message of free thought on, or how do you model that for children, right? You talk about, people would say, okay, well, you're an anarchist and you identify as a Christian.
Yes.
Right? So those are two ideologies, people will call them.
Mm-hmm.
And I know people who are on the left who totally don't understand all of this, public education indoctrination.
Sure.
And they would say, aha, he's going to indoctrinate his children with those ideologies.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you respond to that? Or what does that look like in your house when you're trying to produce self-sufficient free thinkers?
Sure. Well, the first thing I do is I respect my children.
Mm-hmm.
Because respect is the ultimate prerequisite for anarchy. You cannot have an anarchist society without a mutual respect. It doesn't work. So I respect my children. I have explained to them in very matter-of-fact terms how society is structured and what government is. My children, I find, are naturally libertarian in their logical thinking processes. I present opportunities for them to evaluate a scenario. Like, we sit at the dining room table, and I'll say, the one example that was recent that I remember offhand is we were sitting at the table, and one of them asked me what taxes are. They'd heard this word. What are taxes? What's taxes, Daddy? I said, well, let's say that you do a whole bunch of chores around the house. Let's say you clean the house, you pick up your toys, you put the dishes away, you do all these things, and for doing that, I have promised you 3 scoops of ice cream. And they're like, oh yeah, that sounds good. I said, well, when you're done doing all the work, you've been working all day, and you come to get your scoops of ice cream, I take one of the scoops away and I eat it.
Oh, one scoop withholding.
Yeah. How does that make you feel? And they were outraged. They were shouting. John actually said, that's outrageous. And I said, well, that's taxation. That's taxes.
I'm going to channel. All right. I have to channel the liberal now in response. Ah, but yes, for the scoop that you gave up, you get stuff from the scoop stealer.
Mm-hmm.
What do you say?
I would say that the purpose of government is not to give that stuff in exchange for money that I've stolen from you or exchange for that ice cream.
Mm-hmm.
The purpose of government in my house, because I've explained to the children that while they're children and unable to fend for themselves and not unable to make all their own decisions, they can make some decisions, but not all their own decisions, that I am their government right now. But the purpose of me being their government, and this is stuff I've told them this, is to teach you to be self-governing. We talk about self-governance every day. And when they practice non-self-governance, I pointed out, I said, what you're doing right now is the opposite of self-governance. And I say, you making the decision to do the right thing because it's the right thing to do, you know, that is what I'm trying to teach you how to do, and to take care of yourselves, to make decisions that will result in your greatest happiness and that will not infringe on the happiness of other people, okay? So it's not my... I'm not taking that scoop of ice cream, you know, forcibly against their will, but providing them with something supposedly of equal value, mm-hmm. you know?
Right.
The purpose of government is to create self-governing society.
The purpose of you as that, a hand up, not a hand out kind of.
Yes.
Yeah.
The only legitimate government in the world is the family unit. That is the only legitimate government. All government outside, if a person is capable of self-governance, then all outside government is tyranny. So I'm teaching them to govern themselves, and definitely based on a moral code, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure. And I don't have any qualms about saying that I'm bringing up my children in a Christian household with some Christian values. Now, I'm not your typical Christian either.
Mm-hmm.
And I am not liked by many Christians because of some of my views, but that's an entirely different subject.
Sure.
But when it comes down to the teachings of Yeshua, you know, that's what that's what concerns me. That's what I'm interested in, and that's what I'm teaching them. I'm teaching them that love and forgiveness is a better way than hatred and selfishness and cruelty.
Yeah,
you know, and so they're growing up in an environment of love. It's all they know is love. We surround them with love all day long, every day. We give them attention. We give them some discipline. We give them structure. We give them some boundaries. But we give them their own creative processes. And that totally comes to the home education aspect, because I think since we started the home education, and I thank you for that term, because we used to call it homeschooling,
mm-hmm.
but you made a comment at Porkfest this past June that resounded in me like a gong. That, you know, we don't want what we're doing to be compared to what they do in those indoctrination prison camps for children run by the government. I don't want that. We are educating our kids, and they are, because of the way that we do it, I believe this, they are so far ahead of where they would have been if they had stayed in some sort of school system.
Right, which means a lot to them probably, even if they can't realize it yet.
They actually do realize it. It's amazing, because it's funny. I mean, they're like, when they are... Sometimes they'll get wild and rambunctious, and if they're not listening, or if they're whatever, I make the joke that I'm going to send you to school. They're like, no, we don't want to go to school. We don't want to go to school. We want to learn here. And I'm like, okay, like let's come together and get centered and achieve the tasks at hand here. But they have a lot of freedom to learn what they want to learn. Of course, we teach them, you know, reading, writing, and arithmetic. My boys are 8 and 6, and they're both reading on a fourth, fifth grade reading level. They're both doing math that's way farther along than where they would be in first grade, first and second grade. And they both, they're writing stories. You know, they're writing 3-4 page stories, and they're doing, they do art all day long. I give them the option, what do you want to do? What do you want to learn about today? Oh, I want to learn about sharks. Oh, I want to learn about the solar system. Ask my son Andrew what his favorite star is. He'll say Canis Majoris.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I say, where's the Ukraine on a globe? He knows where it is because he wanted to know.
Yeah.
I mean, this past year, I gave him this interactive, like an old school, but interactive almost map of all the U.S. presidents up to George W. Bush, and it had all of their stats and all of their information in it. You push a president, then you can find out all their information. He memorized the entire thing. My little 6-year-old Andrew, he memorized the entire thing, and not because I was making him do it. He would sleep with this thing. He wanted to know. He's interested in history, and I didn't impart that on him. I didn't push that on him. I just gave it to him. And he and I gave him the freedom to learn on his time, in his own space. We don't force them to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we present them. They want to get smarter. They want to want to expand, and we encourage them.
You know, yeah.
We give them all the tools that they could possibly want. And some days we do art all day long. From the time they wake up, I mean, we'll go through an entire stack of printer paper. Because they've just been drawing. They're interested in animation. They're drawing the same drawing but a little bit differently, and they're trying to animate things now. You know, they're little kids. My daughters are almost 5 and 3, and they're way farther along than they would have been 2. And you know, they all sing, they dance, they play, they do their writing, they do their reading, and it's awesome. And we have many curriculums that we pick and choose from,
mm-hmm.
but there's no set curriculum, except we do use the Math UC program for math, and I found that it's an extremely it's a streamlined process for understanding basic mathematics concepts, and they get it like right away. I mean, the first year we did homeschooling, we did an entire year's worth of math in a month.
Yeah,
it was the whole year. We was done in a month, and we're like, all right, let's just move on. They get all this stuff. We don't. This doesn't have to be a grueling process that takes forever. There's families that have kids that are basically doing college courses by the age of 12. I don't see why that couldn't be the norm.
But oh no, yeah, you're right, absolutely.
Yeah,
especially the way things have changed in the last 10 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
So. If you encounter resistance with something, do you just, with one child, do you just change directions or present new options, or
it depends on the kid and the reason that they're upset. If they're feeling like Andrew may get frustrated with a math concept, and I can see it in his eyes. Like I know my kid, you know what I mean. I can see that he's feeling frustrated, and so I'll go over and help him. We'll sit down and we'll do some of this stuff together, you know, and then. If he gets back on track, it's like, you know, pushing a car that's stalled out, you know, and you turn the key as it's moving, it gets going again, and you take off. Okay, he's good. If he just can't get it together, then yeah, we back him off and do something else with him, or let him take a break, or go get a snack.
Mm-hmm.
They have the ability to go to the bathroom whenever they want to go. They have the ability, if they need some fresh air, just to go outside. They're not at the whim of the dictator in front of the class. They're not, you know, listening to bells ringing, teaching them to just obey authority figures and regurgitate memorized answers.
So none of them ever, aside from the two oldest boys, none of them ever who went to a private school. That was the most institutionalized schooling they ever had.
Yes, the girls have never set foot in a school. The boys were basically in a little private Catholic school in our town, a little podunk town. But it was a nice little school. But it was preschool,
mm-hmm.
and we took John out before he went into the first grade. So but in preschool they were learning their letters. They were learning to do some reading. They were learning some stuff. But I found that as soon as he went into school, his communication development became stifled. I got the feeling that I observed him in the class because his teachers were complaining to me about his lack of participation. And mind you, in things that he was perfectly capable of doing at home. And I observed him and I realized that he's looking at everyone in this classroom like they're all crazy.
Yeah.
My kid is looking at everyone else like, what are you all doing? And I realized he wasn't meant for this environment. You know, he is a free thinker. I am a free thinker. And I am encouraging, and so is my wife, and we are encouraging our children to be free thinkers. If they have a legitimate argument against something that we've asked them to do or told them to do, I will listen to it, and as their government, I will make a responsible judgment on their behalf. And they don't always like it, but a lot of times they'll think about it afterwards and they'll say, you know what, Daddy, I accept what you said.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I understand why. So okay, you know, and we don't always agree, but their communication level is through the roof. They prefer to speak to adults because children that they know don't always have the communication skills that they can identify with. So they seek out adults to talk to.
And you're negotiating with them, which is it's what it sounds like. And I think that
sometimes, not all the time.
What would be an example of a place where you wouldn't? If I may ask.
If they wanted ice cream for breakfast, you know, I mean.
So what do you say? I watch, my brothers have kids, and I hear the phrase, because I said so. And
yeah,
I say, okay, you know, I know my middle brother hates Obama.
Mm-hmm.
Just don't get mad when people vote for Obama, you know, if children are talked to like that. So, yeah, I mean, I want ice cream for breakfast, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
It's a ridiculous request. What do you do?
You explain to them that the ingredients in the ice cream will upset their stomachs first thing in the morning, that having all that sugar in their body is unhealthy.
Mm-hmm.
That there are healthier things, delicious things that they could eat for breakfast, and that if their behavior is on par and that there's peace in the house and that the house is not a disaster, that maybe after dinner we'll all have ice cream together.
Mm-hmm.
Because who doesn't like ice cream? The entire Page family loves ice cream. We always keep ice cream. But they know that ice cream is a very special thing. They don't get ice cream every day. You know, I mean, filling your children's bodies with sugar is not only unhealthy, but it's also it's irresponsible, and it is going to ultimately lead to insanity in the house. Because when my children have had a lot of sugar in their bodies, they are complete maniacs. You know, so I have seen both options in action.
Yeah,
and not doing that is the preferable one, and I'll explain that to them.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, bringing out the because I said so card, again, we're talking about teaching them self-governance and teaching them to make good decisions. And sometimes if they're hell-bent on a bad decision, you might let them just make it and suffer the consequences for it.
Yeah.
You know, so that they can learn what the consequence will be. They don't always understand that there will be a reaction to their action. So letting them do that sometimes is a good thing. Like, But they'll end up with a stomach ache, and they'll end up, you know, on their side in their bed going, you know, moaning. And I'm like, well, this is because you ate that ice cream. So now you understand that the next time that you ask for ice cream for breakfast and I say no, that this is why.
Mm-hmm.
Because now you understand that there will be a consequence, a physical consequence of pain that you don't want.
Right. Yeah. Cause and effect.
Exactly.
You have a daughter who's 5.
And almost 5. Yeah.
Almost 5. So I'm gonna use her as an example. How was she introduced to the home education environment? You know, because maybe the other boys had some frame of reference, right? Having spent some time in a school and having that equated with learning,
mm-hmm.
right? But what age was she? How did that conversation go? How did that begin, or was it just always there?
It was always there. Yeah. She was a baby.
Mm-hmm.
She was 6 months old when we moved to Indiana and enrolled the boys in that school. And she has never, She's never done the traditional school thing. Now, that being said, as a homeschool family, we in Indiana until recently we were members of a homeschool co-op that every Friday all the kids would go and they would have a day of with other homeschool kids, other homeschool families, and homeschool moms and dads would volunteer to teach classes. Mm-hmm. And so that was it was like a one day a week on Fridays, like a more structured environment. It definitely had a Christian foundation to it for sure. But that wasn't like the only focus. It was reading, writing, arithmetic, and other subjects. And the kids really liked it, but it was one day a week and it was only for 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
It wasn't an 8-hour day every day of their lives.
Right.
You know, in Montana now, we've moved to Montana recently, and they have the opportunity every Wednesday night to go to a similar type thing, and they love it because they get to be around lots of kids, they have lots of fun, and it's only for an hour and a half to 2 hours.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, I think it's the amount of time we expect children to sit still and memorize information, and the only thing that's important is what their test scores reveal, is just an insane way of expecting children to be educated. And I'm a product of the public education system. I was from the cradle up.
Yeah, I mean,
state institution.
And if we're not intrinsically motivated to do it, it's a waste of time.
It is.
And I wish people understood that. I mean, all we're learning to do is to do school,
mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, then it's the hidden lessons that I laid out in within the first 10 episodes of doing this show 6 years ago, obedience, conformity, and apathy, mm-hmm. You know, and we see the product of that in the world around us,
sure.
Which is something that we're coming to.
Yeah.
But I think that when you were there, when you were growing up, were you aware of what was happening? Because I always felt like, okay, this sucks, but I think it's because something's wrong with me. I think I have a defect. And I think that was reinforced, that idea, through, I mean, you know, I aced elementary school like everyone does, but then get to middle school, you know, to the worksheet slavery of 7th and 8th grade.
Sure.
And then, you know, went into high school, got interested in girls, got interested in smoking pot. I barely even graduated from high school, you know, and I was always just like, well, I'm not cut out for intellectual pursuits. And I took that attitude reluctantly to college.
Yeah.
So how was that experience for you?
School was very easy for me,
mm-hmm.
But I never questioned that anything was amiss until I got to the 11th grade. And I had a really difficult time with trigonometry. And my teacher was only interested in a certain group of students in the class, and the rest of us she ignored. And it required me getting a tutor and just seeking outside help. And I never really got it. I was left behind. And then I remember telling my guidance counselor that I wanted to go to college, and she laughed at me.
Wow.
She actually laughed out loud. She giggled at me. And that made me determined that I was going to go despite her. And I did. And I graduated with honors. I did well. I mean, I was on the dean's list every semester of my college experience. But I didn't put any effort into it. It came naturally to me, but I didn't get a lot out of it. The only real education experience I got in secondary education was I lived in South Africa for a semester of college, my junior year, and that was genuinely challenging. And I learned, from an educational perspective, as far as an institution goes, I learned more from Rhodes University than I ever learned from anywhere else that I had gone. I was completely unprepared for college. I was both maturity-wise, intellectually, in every way. I was completely unprepared for that college experience, and you know, small wonder. You know, I was more interested in the social aspects of school, you know, because I was a long-haired, leather jacket, sunglasses-wearing sort of rebel kind mm-hmm. of kid, and did whatever I wanted to do, and it was just. something I did. I mean, I went to school drunk many times. I just didn't care.
Yeah.
There was a period where I had a lot of apathy, but I also had a modicum of respect for authority. I mean, it was just ingrained in me. I never questioned it. I never said this is wrong. This system is wrong. I never really questioned anything in that way until I wrote Pendulum in 2006 when I was 27 years old.
So this was the song.
This was the song that broke the programming, and then it woke me up, and I realized that there's a whole world of information here that I didn't even know was there. In fact, I was so committed to the pursuit of truth and waking people up to liberty, I didn't even know at the time that there was a liberty movement. I'd never heard of Ron Paul, and I had no idea that anybody was even out there.
How did you define it for yourself or out loud to others?
Well, I was testing the waters at my shows. I would put a song out there and just see how people reacted. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they would be complete indifference. And sometimes people come up to me and say, wow, that song really blew my mind. But I got Pendulum recorded, and I sent it to Gary Franchi, who at the time was the head of Restore the Republic. He's now Next News Network.
Yep.
And he was putting on the Revolution March in Washington, D.C. in July of 2008. And my wife stalked him for like 3 months and, you know, got him to agree to let me perform at this thing, at this big event. And I didn't know what to expect. And I'm standing on this flatbed stage in front of the Capitol on the National Mall, and I see 15,000 people walking towards me shouting, Ron Paul, Ron Paul, freedom, freedom. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, I didn't realize that this is what it is. This is something huge that I'm just a little blip in. Like, I don't have to start a movement. There's already a movement. There's a huge movement. And that was also a pivotal day. That was when I met Ron for the first time. It's when I met Adam Kokesh for the first time, Ernest Hancock. It's when I met Gary for the first time. And all these people are very close friends of mine now.
Yeah.
So that event was a very pivotal moment when I realized that there was this huge body of people and this consciousness movement that was sweeping everywhere. And I just dove headfirst into it.
The song, is there like a line or a verse that really captures that transformation for you?
Yeah, there's several, I think. Let's see. I saw a president.
President blind to the needs of his people. Saw a camel that passed through the eye of a needle. Saw a group of old men whose money was evil. Saw a cross breaking free from a cage of a steeple. Saw beggars and cripples dying in squalor. A son whose sins had exceeded his father. Saw a nation of sleepers whose dreams were forgotten. And a bushel of apples from a tree that was rising. And a pendulum swings from the left to the right. Its momentum increases the need for the fight. Like a blindfold when it's time to walk toward the light. And I am lost somewhere in the middle.
Did you have any political awareness?
None. Zero.
Zero.
I knew that people were having conversations, that other adults were having conversations about foreign policy and economics and
the war.
And I wanted no part of it. I didn't want to know. I was so lazy you would not recognize me.
What did you study in college?
I majored in cultural anthropology. I was interested in people and in cultures and in people's habits. And that's one reason that I went to South Africa, was I wanted to study the township culture of post-apartheid South Africa.
Okay, I put a mental bookmark in it too when you said it. You said Rhodes University, mm-hmm. as in Cecil.
Yes.
So what was that experience? Now, Cecil Rhodes has come up a lot on this show, mm-hmm. and is a central figure in,
yes,
not conspiracy theories, an open conspiracy, mm-hmm. essentially, which basically boils down to a desire and plans that followed that desire to reassimilate the United States into the British Empire. you know, starting in the 1890s and the first decade of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this was somebody who was learning at, you know, Oxford University that the British owe it to the world to, you know, basically disseminate their culture.
Sure.
To the people who weren't fortunate enough to be British. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we saw that play out in the 20th century through things like the Royal Institute,
the Royal Institute of International Affairs.
Yeah, and the Council on Foreign Relations, the American counterpart. And, you know, those things serving as a model for other types of globalist projects.
Yes.
So I wonder, and so there's an immediate suspicion that comes for me whenever I hear somebody was a Rhodes Scholar, which is not what we're talking about here. But I'm just wondering what the culture was in a place like that, Rhodes University.
It was very interesting. What we're discussing now about Cecil Rhodes, I wasn't even mildly aware of the depth of that man's ambitions and depravity at the time.
You know?
Rhodes University is an amazing institution. I mean, it's an incredible place to learn. Post-apartheid South Africa is, you know, in the year 2000, which is when I was there, was a very interesting place. We're talking about 6 years post-apartheid, but it was still very much an apartheid situation, because, you know, the only difference is that there was now the rise of a black middle class, and you didn't have the totalitarian police, jackbooted thugs kicking in people's doors and kidnapping in the middle of the night and never to be heard from again. That wasn't happening anymore. But you had, with that power vacuum, you had 1,000 times more crime, unfortunately. You had, under apartheid, beggars were not permitted to be in the town limits begging.
Mm-hmm.
And now there's, like, in Grahamstown, which is where Rhodes University is, you walk down the main street, which is High Street, and on one side of the street, there are literally close to 1,000 beggars from the local township of Rini, and which is just outside Grahamstown. And then on the other side of the street, you have all these, you know, white shops, essentially,
right,
where people are sipping milkshakes, and over here people are begging for a few coins to buy something to eat for their family, and it was a very, almost like a cartoon dichotomy, a cartoonist dichotomy. It was so blatantly obvious to me, and I spent a lot of time on the left side of the street. And I actually ended up becoming friends with a lot of the poor folks. I was learning their language too. Khalsa has the clicks,
yeah.
And it's one of two prominent dialects and native dialects in South Africa. There's Khalsa and there's Zulu, and they're somewhat similar, but there's a lot of big differences, vernacular differences. And I was so interested in what their experience of life was, and I did a lot of interviews with a lot of the poor folks from the township. I actually stayed in the township for a time too. I lived in the township and just kind of studied the habits and their daily lives, routines, religion. You know, it was an amazing experience. But it was almost like kind of a micro vision of what, you know, you go into the supermarket and there's three types of shampoo. Not 10,000 types of shampoo,
right? Right.
You know, and it was reminiscent of American culture, but American culture is also looked at as absurd. There, you know, and
how so?
Well, you know, like the show Married with Children.
Yeah,
you know, all the men in my res, we all watched this together, and because they all loved Kelly Bundy, Christine Applegate, but they just they. It was always like, you know, effing Americans, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
this is the best that America has to offer. Like, no, it's not.
Right.
It's not. You know, like they get like the worst aspects of our culture, you know, sent over there. Like, that's what the TV stations buy, is that kind of programming. So, or at least it was. But everyone wants to go to America anyway. you know, because just for economic reasons, because they're have just in their minds they have much better opportunities financially over here, or they want to go to England.
Yeah,
there's what they call the big brain drain was going on while I was there. We're all like the real highly educated people were leaving the country, and I guess, I mean, I understood why, but you know, South Africa is an amazing place. It's an amazing place.
So you have, at least in the 20th century, one of the best examples of culture clash.
Yeah,
you know, of and also. White South Africans who historically are British and
British or Dutch
and Africans who are historically African.
Yes.
You know, I don't even know if coexisting is the right word in the context of the apartheid.
It's not.
But you're there after it ends.
Right after. Yeah. I mean, you have to understand, like, we're talking about an entire indigenous population.
Yeah.
That was legislated out of its freedom,
yeah,
obliviously. They had no way of interacting with this legislature. They had no way of countering it, and slowly, incrementally, through attrition over time,
yeah,
all of a sudden they have to carry papers to travel anywhere.
Right.
At one point, there was a massive campaign basically to forcibly remove people from their homes and forcibly relocate them to reserve areas called the Bantustans.
Yeah.
And then they would literally hundreds of thousands of people in these desolate areas, squatter camps, where they had homes.
Yeah.
Now they're out here in the middle of nowhere, and they're being bussed into the cities before the sun comes up to work, to do, you know, as servants, and then they're being bussed back at night, and they're getting a few hours of sleep. And when they grow up in the apartheid school system, I was told this firsthand by people who grew up in this system, that they were taught by their teachers in their textbooks that black Africans were created to be a subhuman race,
mm-hmm,
to serve their white masters.
No, there was a lot of science that, not maybe to the extent of serving white masters, but there was a lot of science devoted to that in the early 20th century. And, you know, it's interesting. Some of it is making a comeback now, and that was one of the reasons why I summed up what you had said in your story about being there with this culture clash. Mm-hmm. There was such an awareness of racial and cultural differences in that location. Now, I understand the two are barely comparable beyond that, what was going on there then and what's going on here now. But when we come to this exploitation of racial and cultural differences that we're seeing in the United States today, do you feel like that experience gives you any unique perspective on what's happening here now?
What do you mean by what's happening here now?
Well, I know this came up in your conversation on Radical Agenda, right? That there is a very significant effort I see mostly through the media to ignite a race war, mm-hmm, in this country.
Sure.
And race is nothing new. You know, I grew up in New Hampshire and everyone was white, and then Rodney King. So that was like 1992, and then, yeah, OJ, mm-hmm, you know, and that was 3,000 miles away. It might've been a different world, but that, yeah, was the wake up to me that, oh, interesting. You know, like, I mean, I had learned about Martin Luther King in school. I was 14, 15 years old when Rodney King happened. But Martin Luther King, that's just very abstract. He's a hero. People used to be bad and have ignorant attitudes. But then Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks single-handedly changed that, according
surely,
to school. Yeah. So race has always been here. But I just feel like it's gotten particularly bad in the last 5 or 6 years. But the acceleration in the last few months, everything is about awareness of race and cultural differences.
Well, divide and conquer is,
right,
is a strategy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, if you want to create a socialist or communist sort of society, there needs to be, you need to pit groups of people against each other. Divide and conquer.
Yeah.
That's been my my criticism of a lot of these, you know, anti-police movements, because you're not going to find someone who, is more anti-police brutality than myself.
Right.
It's one of my singular causes. But, you know, a lot of our, you know, black brothers and sisters are angry with white people for these issues when they should be angry with the state for perpetrating this violence. It's a culture of violence from agents of the state. And I think that a lot of anger is being misdirected and is being fueled on purpose.
Yeah.
I know from interviewing people from Ferguson, for example, they knew for a fact that people were being bussed in from outside the city, from other parts of the area, even from Illinois, purposefully to destroy things, to make it more than it was. You know, I've said this a million times. I think that a lot of these situations are training exercises in order to see how easy it is to take over a town.
You think there's a design to it?
Absolutely, there's a design to it. It's a game of chess. There's so many false flag attacks going on.
Who do you think's bussing them in, first of all, before, because it's gonna segue into what you're saying now, but who's bussing these people into Ferguson?
I mean, there's groups like Acorn that do that kind of stuff.
Okay.
I mean, George Soros has been implicated in a lot of that kind of thing, using proxy groups in order to, but he's paying for this to happen.
Yeah.
The state is basically testing its own power to see how easy it is to subjugate us. See, these are test groups, okay? Like, you capitalize on a problem. You capitalize on an incident. Never let a tragedy go to waste, as they say.
Right.
And you capitalize on that problem, and you exacerbate it in order to justify a militarized presence of force. And see what happens. How easy is it to take over an area? How easy is it to deprive people of their rights? How easy is it to convince people to willingly hand them over?
Yeah.
You know, so it's create the problem and then be the solution.
Yeah, and people are naively participating in this. So with an organization like Black Lives Matter, sure, there's plenty of conversations to have about crime in black communities, you know, being perpetrated by the people there. Now, I think that's kind of a dodge when maybe conservatives say, oh, well, black people kill black people. I don't really think that that's what Black Lives Matter is about, but it's definitely an important part of that conversation. But it's just par for the course to not look at that when there's an outgroup to blame, which is white police, right? Now,
but not just white police. There's police of all shapes and sizes and colors and creeds that are perpetuating police brutality.
Absolutely there is. But what I'm saying is that phenomenon with Black Lives Matter is a microcosm that extends to other black causes, other white causes, where it's just in-group, out-group, right? And that's unfortunate. And that's what I mean, that people are participating in this kind of unwittingly.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I think we're all being manipulated all the time. And there is an overall agenda to have people have this idea that they need government to protect them, to take care of them,
mm-hmm.
to give them what they need, and ultimately subservience to the state and absolute dependence on the state is going to come from that. I mean, violence is the only way that the state can maintain its power, and our compliance with that system of violence is what gives the state its power.
Yeah.
So if we as a population withdrew our consent and withdrew our compliance from that system, it would be impotent and ineffectual.
Yeah, relatively quickly. With not that many people.
Exactly. And that's one of many things that I'm trying to show folks,
mm-hmm.
is that this is not as complicated as it sounds. You know, I mean, like, it's going to take time. I mean, we didn't get into this mess in a year.
Right.
You know, yeah. We're not going to get out of it in a year.
Right.
It's going to take generations to get to, but it has to start somewhere. Because if it doesn't start, if the walk away from tyranny doesn't begin now, we're at a pretty pivotal time where it's going to slide downhill pretty quickly. And that's, as a father, I don't want my children to see that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm a student of history, and it's not very difficult to see where that slope leads, because other countries have gone down this path. The very fact that we have an existing law, the National Defense Authorization Act, that allows the military to indefinitely detain American citizens on suspicion of, you know, whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
It shows how far we've come, and in the wrong direction, and hardly anyone knows that it exists.
Exactly. So take what we've talked about, much of what we've talked about, and tie it together, and I'll present it as one final question. You know, I talked earlier in the conversation about a reluctance that I had most of my adult life to procreate, you know, and one of the rationalizations for that, through much of my years where I was at the age where it would be normal, according to society, to be thinking about getting married and having children. Really, from like 30 to 37, I said, the world in which I would have to raise these children is too damn unpredictable. And especially once I started this show and became a public enemy of the state in an ever-expanding state,
mm-hmm.
you know, that created a lot of new apprehension in me.
I understand.
How did you, or how do you continue to manage that concern that to some extent must be there?
Of course it's there.
Yeah.
Of course it's there. I understand you.
Mm-hmm.
I understand what you're saying.
Right.
And I have those feelings too. But I also understand that greater is the force that is in me than is in the world trying to destroy me. And my children are part of a much larger plan to help the world, to spread love, because the world is love deficient. It's understanding deficient. It's not cruelty and hatred deficient. It's got plenty of that.
Right.
And more people who are liberty-minded and who have this deep moral compass, this well-grounded moral compass, need to be having more children to counteract the tidal wave of ignorance that's running rampant because of many factors, but not the least of which is state intervention in their education.
Yeah.
I mean, our children are being raised by the state. I mean, why do you think the average college student doesn't know who won the Revolutionary War?
Yeah, it's true.
It's not hard to understand. They don't want people to know about the Revolutionary War because there's another Revolutionary War coming down the road.
And you believe that, yeah.
I do believe that.
Yeah.
That's why I wrote Arm Yourselves. Arm Yourselves is my new single.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, it's a call to action. It's wake up. It's not about guns. It's about truth. It's about what is happening. What are the trends pointing to? We've been down this road before. You know, I mean, all of these moves towards gun confiscation, for example, are indicative of what the plan is. Over 270 million people were murdered in the 20th century by their governments immediately following gun confiscation. The weapons in the hands of American citizens is the only thing keeping this country from completely falling apart and being taken over by military dictatorship.
It's the
only
thing. Yeah.
The only thing. And so, you know, I tell people to, you know, to arm yourselves. Yes, arm yourselves with force to protect yourselves and your family and your communities. Absolutely. 100% stand by it. But I also tell people to arm yourselves with information, with knowledge. Arm yourselves spiritually. However you do that. For me, I arm myself with the Holy Spirit and with the Spirit of Yeshua.
I think the general principle there is to become people who are capable of handling the responsibility of freedom.
Sure, absolutely. That's a huge, and that comes with understanding the truth and being educated and getting prepared, learning skills, becoming self-sufficient. disconnecting from the system, disconnecting from the machine and the systems of control that govern almost every aspect of our lives. Being self-sufficient is a huge part of arming oneself. Because when the trucks start, when the trucks stop running on the highways, mm-hmm. and the grocery stores are empty, that's when you really see where people are in their level of evolution.
So you think that day is coming?
I do. I think there's a very thin veneer of civility mm-hmm. in society. And I've seen instances with my own eyes where it was temporarily stripped away.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, true.
And even if you just look at the videos that surface every Black Friday now, that's just insanity based on consumerism, on greed and selfishness.
Yeah, that's 20% off.
That's 20% off. Imagine right. when these people are not having their basic needs met.
Yeah.
Zombie movies are based on this phenomenon. Mm-hmm. Zombies are a metaphor for the roving masses of, you know, hapless marauders.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm encouraging everyone to educate yourself on the facts. Don't be manipulated by corporate media, which is essentially a government-controlled propaganda machine. Think for yourself, and I have ultimate skin in the game because there's nothing more important to me than my family.
Right.
There's nothing more important than my children. I'd give my life for them and without a second thought, and I want them to grow up in peace. I don't want them to see the horror of civil war and what it would mean in the 21st century. I don't. That's not even the last thing I'd ever want them to see.
Yeah.
But if I don't do something, then they're going to see it. But if they do see it, then that, to me, that means they were meant to see it. They're meant to be here. My wife and I have both felt, since we had kids, that each one of these kids is extremely special. There's something going on with each of these children. They have a destiny. Mm-hmm. And if that means having to fight to preserve liberty here, then so be it. So I need to prepare them too. I need to arm them too. With all the faculties that they're going to need,
yeah.
But let's get to you because,
well, see the whole outbreeding the state argument, and I know that's not quite what you're saying. It always seemed a little too, and it's not the case anymore. It always seemed a little too Game of Thronesy to mm-hmm. me, like
Game of Thronesy,
you know, like breeding for a legacy kind of idea, you know.
Well, but it's not about me though. The legacy isn't about me.
That's it, and yeah. that's what. But in more practical terms, you know, I started to feel like that's not a reason to not do this because, you know, how many things have I done that I didn't want to do because I was afraid to do them or apprehensive about doing them that ultimately had huge payoffs?
Sure.
Almost everything that had a huge payoff.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's an extra level of complexity here because it involves another human being who doesn't get to participate in that decision. And that makes it a little trickier for me. But, you know, I think just even... I mean, who's to say that I have a child and this is another line of thinking, okay? So I'm just gathering thoughts I've had and blurting them out at this point.
Sure.
Who's to say my child even becomes liberty-minded? I think they would.
That's a right? perfectly valid
question. But I know a lot of people who I don't see. This just creates the fear. Like, I don't think I would be susceptible because I have done so much preparation in research about parenting and education that I'm really confident that as long as I keep my shit together, you know, I would do a good job.
Mm-hmm.
But in bringing these people into the world, there is this kind of hopeful feeling that I have about the leverage of one individual.
Sure.
You and I are having a conversation right now on what is today? Thursday, December 10th.
Yes.
By Christmas, more people will have heard this than I would have reached in an entire career of 30 years teaching. It's pretty amazing.
Yes.
Right? The leverage that one or two people can have in spreading this message.
Correct.
There's going to be hundreds who might not agree with everything I said or everything you said, but they sat here, they listened. They, you know, their minds were stimulated.
Yes.
You know, and that's a good thing. That means a lot to me. So you have, you know, six youngsters.
Yes.
Who could easily have that power based on the way that you've described their upbringing.
Yes.
And that's exciting. That's inspiring.
That's the idea.
Yeah. I like that. I'm turning around this apprehension. Based on the fact that I can't control the other 8 billion people who will be on the world by the time, you know, they're 6 or 7 years old.
True.
So,
but you can control to a degree, to a large degree,
yeah,
the environment in which your child or children are brought up.
Yeah.
And in the environment that my wife and I have created, they are surrounded by love. That's what they know.
Yeah.
And that's what they show to others. That's what's needed. The world is what we make it. And the world is what we teach our children to make it. I want the world to be a loving and peaceful place where people can be free. Well, it's not going to be that if we don't raise new generations who have those ideals,
right,
who have those desires too.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be filled with ignorance and strife. And that's not what I want. John Adams has a quote that I'll paraphrase. He was asked when he was in France why he was doing what he was doing. And he says, I study war and politics so that my sons can study history and mathematics so that my grandchildren can study art and music and poetry.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why I'm doing what I'm doing. And maybe my children will have battles that they've been designed to combat. But my grandchildren may be more free. Every generation should be more free than the last. And if we don't create those generations, if people like you are not creating those generations, people like me, then what do we have? You know, right. I always call society like this big block of cheese, right? And the cheese grater of truth, when society is, people are pressed up against it, they go through a very painful transition of becoming this individual. Well, the Liberty community is a handful of those individual flakes.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's a painful transition.
Yeah.
You know, it requires breaking free from the collective.
Yeah.
But ultimately, it's a very empowering process. And because I was not brought up in a culture of liberty, I was brought up in a culture of obedience.
Exactly.
So I'm bringing up my children in a culture of love and freedom, and that will be what they know.
Right.
And they will recognize the opposite of that very easily because it'll be the opposite of everything that they know.
Yeah.
And I think it'll make it easier for them to change it. I woke up when I was 27. Imagine what I could have accomplished by now if I'd woken up when I was 18 or if I had been taught this since birth. But my parents never questioned this stuff either.
Right.
And their parents never questioned. And their parents never questioned. They just accepted. It's the way it's always been, son.
I think that even there are questions, right? But, I mean, you think about most people, they had no place for those questions to go. They had no support system for whatever dissent they might have felt. So much of it was just silent.
Sure.
You know, I bet there were a lot of unanswered questions about you know, Western civilization by the people of Western civilization over the last 500, 600, 700 years.
Sure.
But there was no comfort in asking most of those questions out loud. And that's really, really transformed in our lifetimes, you know, in ways that it can potentially be constructive. You know, our parents got their chance, you know, when the world went to shit in the mid to late 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them re-assimilated.
Yes.
And because they didn't have real problem-solving strategies, mm-hmm. you know?
They were doing their best.
I wish I could just pull it out. Maybe I have it under the table here. I found this poster. My mom, in 2008, or whatever year it was, voted for John McCain. I was helping her clean out her basement. I found an anti-war poster.
Interesting.
You know, from 1970, that said, "War is bad for children and other living things."
Yes, I know this. Yeah.
Yeah.
And she voted for John McCain.
38 years later.
That's it. Well, I mean, that's a very interesting.
Yeah. I talked to her about it. I had lots of questions.
Yeah, I'll bet.
You know, but they had their chance and they didn't have at their fingertips, you know, the resources that we do and the connections that we do.
This is true.
And to me, even when I look out in the world today, especially in the last few months, especially in the last few weeks, I say, wow, something is coming.
Yeah.
There's going to be a change. And I always just kind of saw it as some non-specific future event.
What do you see it as now?
I don't know, but I see people feeling like it's a problem necessary for the government, you know, to solve.
Yeah.
And I think I see a lot of people being pitted against each other in really, really dangerous, aggressive, hostile ways where it's going to move beyond rhetoric and Twitter wars soon, you know?
Yeah.
And
I know a lot of people who are prepared.
And it is,
it is
moving beyond that. And what some kind of civil disturbance,
civil
kind
unrest.
Of event. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. On a large scale. You know, I live in a city. I mean, fortunately, I live, you know, kind of away from the center of the city. But I'm in a high population area.
Yes,
things like that have started to concern me.
We also had this concern, too.
Yeah.
We were living in Annapolis, Maryland. We just had a little baby girl, our third child, and I couldn't get down our street at 1 o'clock in the afternoon on a weekday for all the gridlock.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm going to be out of ammo by the time I get my wife and these three children off this peninsula on foot. So I said, we have to get out of here. And that was one big reason that we moved to Indiana, was to find a safer place to be. And then ultimately we wanted to be out west in the what they call the Great American Redoubt.
Yeah.
So that's where we are now, and it's a much more liberty conscious, freedom conscious environment, and everyone has a much more free mindset out there. Most of the people that I've met anyway say that there's a very beautiful concentration of freedom-minded families out there, and I'm so psyched to be there.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Why don't we leave it there for today? That was a lot.
Yeah. We solved all the world's problems, Brett. You and me.
Well, that's a relief. I was stressed at the beginning of the conversation. So how can people in my audience help you out if they're interested? Can you tell us a little bit about what you're working on right now and how people can participate?
Well, there's several things. I just released a new single called "Arm Yourselves,"
yeah,
and it's got a B-side called "Act 3," which is an instrumental battle scene that it's like both songs go together, but they're two separate tracks. And I just released that, and it's on iTunes, it's on CD Baby, on Amazon, Google Play Store, anywhere you download music, that's where it is. You can also get it pretty easily just going to my website, which is jordanpagemusic.com. If people want to donate to help me stay on the road and to help fund my different projects, I have a PayPal account just with jordanpagemusic@gmail.com is the address. Any donations are appreciated. I am working on putting a budget together for my next album, but the most pertinent issue is the video for Arm Yourselves. So through participation with Oath Keepers, which is a national veterans organization that educates active military troops about their oath to the Constitution,
mm-hmm.
you know, and in trying to convince them not to shoot us when they're given the order to down
mm-hmm.
the road.
Mm-hmm.
I've been involved with this organization for since 2009, many years, and they've come on board as a supporter of this song, and we're going to do a music video that really makes the case for liberty, makes the case for the Second Amendment, for natural law, natural rights, and we're accumulating sponsors right now to help pay for it. That's really coming along really well. I'm very excited about that. So I mean, I'm looking for a few more, you know, sort of liberty minded companies that are interested in being part of this as a sponsor. I think I've got it locked down, but you know, I'm always open to having more help with this. But it's going to be like a 10-minute short film that is, I think it's going to just knock people's socks off, and I think it's going to piss a lot of people off, and it's going to make a lot of other people very excited, and I think it's going to be good. So we're planning on doing that this coming year, early in the next few months,
mm-hmm.
start shooting with that. That's a big project. And
a lot of valuable growth opportunities in pissing people off.
Oh, I agree. I do it every day.
Yep.
I think that I'm hopeful, I should say, that the success of Arm Yourselves will allow me to get the next album done over the next few months. That's my hope.
Mm-hmm.
So the more people download it, the more able I will be to have the budget necessary to produce the next album. And the next album is really going to be the best work that I've done to date. I'm very excited about all the new songs. I really have two albums that I could record, but if I could just get the very next one done, I'd be very happy. And then to get that out there, you know, before it's too late.
Absolutely. Jordan Page, a powerful voice in more ways than one. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you being here.
I enjoyed this. Thank you so much.
Awesome.